Hello, folks, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Feature. I'm your host, Tom Major. We're going to talk about bats today, and we have a subject matter expert here in the studio. He's a wildlife biologist from the United States Forest Service. His name is Scott Worson. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, Tom. It's great to be here.
Great. I'm so glad you're here because you're be able to talk authoritatively about this subject. We're going to talk about bats. And so, Scott, many people have fears of bats, but what is the definition or the name of the syndrome of when you're afraid of bats?
Yes. So chiroptophobia is the fear of bats. Hopefully none of the listeners have chiroptophobia. And after today, hopefully people appreciate bats a little bit more.
Maybe even love them.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. It's so a privilege to have you on the program. Let's have a word of prayer. Our great Heavenly Father, just be with us as we tend after your creatures, that we are stewards, that we hold these, in a sense, graciously and carefully in our hands. And we thank you. Be with our subject and help us to understand it better. In Jesus' name, amen. Scott, tell us about bats. You know, I can name maybe two or three of them. Some are small and some are large. You know, the ones you see on the nature shows are always very large or very small. Tell us a little bit about this spectrum of bats.
Yeah, so I think bats are some of the most interesting critters we have. So bats are mammals, just like us. Bats are the only mammals that can fly, that can truly fly.
That's notable.
Yeah, that's absolutely notable. There's flying squirrels, which can't actually fly. Flying squirrels glide. So bats are the only mammal that can truly fly. There are over 1,400 species of bats worldwide.
1,400. That's way beyond. I was going to say about 14 would be on the high end.
Yeah, yeah. I was surprised to read that myself. Bats occur on 6 of the 7 continents. Antarctica is the only continent without bats. So those that have chiroptophobia, Antarctica might be a nice refuge for you. And bats use echolocation as well, where they can produce sounds, listen to the echoes, and tell where they are in their environment based on that.
I understand that at one time we didn't have radar. Is radar part of echolocation?
Radar uses basically the same principle, using echoes, using sound wave bumps off objects to understand where you are in the environment.
And it seemed like they did some research because they thought this was such an important thing to learn about. And some of the technology we have today is based on echolocation bats.
Yeah, it's the same principle.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful. Let's talk about those bats a little bit, the micro bats and the macro bats.
Yeah, so we can split bats worldwide. We can split bats up into two basic groups, the micro bats and the mega bats or macro bats. So the micro bats are the bats we have here in Michigan are all in that micro bat group.
They look pretty big to me.
Yeah, they're not much bigger than a mouse, the micro bats. And those are the bats that use echolocation.
So they don't all?
Not all bats.
Really?
The mega bats don't echolocate. The micro bats eat mostly insects, bugs, moths, stuff like that. And then the mega bats are a little bit bigger. They might be a few pounds. They eat mostly fruit or seeds, and they tell where they are in their environment, mostly just using vision, not echolocation.
Wow, I learned something just right now because I thought they all did. When you say a couple pounds, do you have some idea? It's amazing, as I've seen, their wingspan can be pretty wide, but their torsal, if that's the right word, how tall would their torsal possibly be?
So the largest bat in the world, it's one in the Philippines called the flying fox, which is a great name. I would guess that one could be as tall as maybe a foot and a half. The wingspan on the flying fox can get up to 6 feet wide.
I think that would be a little intimidating.
Yeah, that would absolutely be intimidating.
Just a simple question, do all bats fly at night?
Yes, as far as I know, all bats fly at night.
Okay, okay. What else about these bats should we know to add to our appreciation?
Well, another interesting fact, the fastest bat ever recorded was the Mexican free-tailed bat, recorded flying over 100 miles per hour. It's faster than a peregrine falcon.
No way. Is that in a dive or is this a horizontal flight?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You'd have to, I would think it'd be diving to get that kind of speed.
Right, right.
But yeah, that's fast.
What about their food sources? You talked about insects. Do they eat anything besides, they eat fruit, don't they?
So the megabats, they eat fruit, seeds, pollen, that type of thing. And then the microbats, like the bats we have here in Michigan, eat insects, and that's their primary food.
Now, they can eat quite a bit of insects over time?
Yeah, absolutely. So mosquitoes are our big food source for the bats we have around here. And so little brown bat, that's a species we have, can eat over 600 mosquitoes an hour.
We need more of those bats.
Yeah, we sure do. We sure do.
What about their impact on the environment?
So, you know, bats, they have a couple important roles in the environment. One that I just alluded to is pest control. They eat mosquitoes, beetles, flies, other critters like that. And then these megabats, the ones that eat fruit and pollen, they're also important pollinators. So a lot of the fruits that we love to eat are pollinated by bats. Things like avocados, bananas, cashews, coconuts, those are all pollinated by bats. If we didn't have bats, you wouldn't have those.
Well, that's serious. But one of the things that people can greatly appreciate is I saw that that they also pollinate chocolate or the coca bean.
Yeah, so chocolate comes from the cacao plant.
That's right.
And that is another plant that is pollinated by bats. So no bats, no chocolate.
Well, that should raise their appreciation scale very, very significantly.
It does in my book. Absolutely. I love chocolate. And then another interesting thing about bats, their droppings, guano, is a great fertilizer. It's high in nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. And so people actually collect bat guano, and it's an ingredient in fertilizer.
So I assume that that's not from our microbats, but more from our macro or bats?
I'm not sure exactly where guano is collected. I would think elsewhere. I don't think we have bats in any quantity where it would be worthwhile collecting their guano, but who knows?
Hey, let's also talk about their wings. Those are quite interesting. You know, we're thinking about birds and stuff. They have feathers, but bats do not have feathers.
They don't. Bats have hair. Remember, they're a mammal. So the Latin name for bat, chiropteran, means hand wing. And that's how bats fly. Their hand, they have these really elongated fingers. If you look at your thumb and your pointer finger, you see there's that little flap of skin.
Oh, yes.
Between you. Imagine that stretched all the way between every single one of your fingers.
That'd be a membrane, right?
Exactly, membrane. We call it the patagium on bats. So they have that membrane between all of five of their digits, and that's what provides the surface, the wing surface, for them to have flight.
So each one of those joints or fingers, does that come to the torso of the bat, and then the membrane spread between that?
So the membrane is spread between their fingers, and then they also have a membrane that goes from their arm down to their torso.
We're getting into specifics here, aren't we?
Yeah. Yep.
Now, bats, I read something, and please explain that. Bats tend to hang upside down, and there's a reason for that. Please explain that.
There is. So unlike birds, you might see them on the ground, and they fly up when you startle them. Bats can't fly from the ground. They aren't strong enough flyers to do that. So they'll climb up and hang from the branch of a tree so that when they want to take flight, they can drop. And they can take flight while they're dropping, but they can't actually take flight from the ground. They'd have to climb up on another object.
So then they fly high enough to drop down, grab a hold of something to hang on, and then that's preparing for the next flight.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, I might be running off course here, but when do they sleep?
Yeah. So most bats sleep during the day and then are active at night.
Where do they tend to rest?
Yeah, that's a good question. So most of the bats we have here in Michigan will roost, that's what we call it, when they sleep during the day, in dead or dying trees. So if there's loose bark, they might go under that, or if there's a hole in a tree. But anyone who's lived in an old house knows those aren't the only places bats roost. They like attics, and they seem to find their way into old houses quite often. They're curious animals. So there are some species, the big brown bat and the little brown bat, unique names.
Yeah.
Those species will roost in houses, in man-made structures.
Well, yes. Growing up, we had one house that there was no problem with the number of species in that particular house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk. We talked about echolocation a little bit earlier. Is there more details about? I mean, it seems like I've seen some nature programs on this, and it was quite interesting how they send out a high pitched sound. I'll let you finish the.
Yeah. I mean, so imagine you're a bat at night. It's pitch dark out, and you're trying to find something the size of a mosquito or a moth to eat it.
That'd be pretty tough to find.
But this echolocation is amazing. There are some bats that can identify objects as small as a strand of human hair.
Wow.
Just based on the echoes off of that object. So bats produce this high-pitched sound. It exits through their mouth or their nose, and it bounces off objects, and that helps them figure out what's out there in the environment.
Do they have a vocal cord? How do they make that sound?
They do have a voice box, yes, a larynx.
Okay, well, good. I must have remembered something from that video. Let's talk a little bit about bats in Michigan. Now, we want to take a wide scope. I don't know, is the habitat different from the western UP down to the Detroit, southeast Michigan, southwest Michigan, or is this pretty generic territory? Or?
So we have 9 species of bat in Michigan, and they're primarily associated with forested habitat. As you get further south in Michigan, there's less and less forest. But for the most part, the 9 bats we have are associated with forest.
Very good. So those who are in urban areas, how would they go about, if they were interested in looking for the bats, where would they see them? Or don't we see them around street lights or something like that at night?
You can often at night. You can see bats foraging around streetlights, looking for the bugs that are attracted to streetlights. And even in urban areas, there are bats. Like I said, in old houses, you can find them. And even in trees, big trees in urban areas can be bat habitat.
Well, good. I'm kind of trying to decide which direction to go. Well, I'll tell you what. Listeners, why don't we take a break right now? I'm talking with a wildlife biologist from the United States Forest Service. This is Scott Warson, and we'll be back after this break. Stay tuned.
I am so thankful that Strong Tower Radio provides solid, biblical teaching and God-honoring music to encourage me day by day. I have been so blessed by the programming I hear, and I count it a privilege to be a regular supporter of this station. Won't you pray for Strong Tower Radio? And then call 877-278-5512 or go online to strongtowerradio.org to make a tax-free donation to keep this radio station on the air.
We're back. I'm Tom Majeur, your host of Strong Tower Radio Feature with Scott Warson. He's a wildlife biologist with the United States Forest Service. Scott, when you were a little child growing up, did you always want to be a wildlife biologist?
That's a good question, Tom. No. So when I was a kid, I didn't even know you could make a career in wildlife biology.
Can you imagine getting paid for something you like doing?
Yeah, I couldn't at the time, but that's what I do now. Yeah, so when I was a kid, I grew up in Grand Rapids, downstate, and I was always interested in science, interested in the natural world. I liked to get outside, go hunting and fishing. Never considered it as a career, but I ended up at Kelvin College in Grand Rapids, and I studied biology there. And I had some really great professors and mentors there who really encouraged me to follow my passion. Like they say, if you find a job doing what you love, you never work a day in your life.
Right.
And my passion is the natural world. And so I graduated with a biology degree from Kelvin. And right after I graduated, I went out to Yellowstone National Park, got a job there as a wildlife technician, radio tracking wolves and coyotes.
All the stuff you watch on TV, yeah. All that stuff.
It was like a dream. I loved every day of it. And I knew I had to make a career in wildlife biology.
You probably were sad that the summer was over.
I was. And so after that, I bummed around to different seasonal wildlife jobs. Moving around the country, I worked with white-tailed deer, with rattlesnakes, with turtles, a whole bunch of different species.
You have to pay your dues kind of in this industry, right?
Yeah, yep. So I got experience lots of different habitats, different species, and realized if I wanted to get a permanent job, graduate school would probably be a good idea. I completed a master's degree in wildlife biology through the State University of New York, and soon after that, I got my first job with the U.S. Forest Service. And I've worked in wildlife for the Forest Service for 10 years now.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of young people after hearing this program will want to consider a career in wildlife biology.
Yes, I highly recommend it.
So you mentioned about hunting and fishing, but did you catch frogs when you were a kid?
I did catch frogs. I loved catching frogs. And now I take my kids out and we catch frogs. Catch and release.
Okay, there, yeah. Yes, because we got to watch those frogs too, yep. To be good stewards.
Yep.
Hey, listen, we're talking about being a steward. Conservation efforts, there's some concerns about bats. What is the concern? Maybe give us the latest of there's some problems with that. Explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, so there are a few different threats to bats here in Michigan and nationwide, really. One of the biggest ones is a disease called white nose syndrome. So white nose syndrome is a fungus that impacts bats when they're hibernating. It only showed up in the last 15 years or so. It's a fungus from Eurasia. And this fungus impacts bats. So bats, when they hibernate, certain species will hibernate in these big colonies, thousands and thousands of bats all huddled together. And this fungus wakes bats up when they're hibernating. And if you think about the middle of winter, bats that eat mosquitoes, moths, bugs, they're not out in the winter. And so bats come out and there's nothing for them to eat. Water's frozen, there's nothing for them to drink, and they end up starving. And so this white nose syndrome, it's caused by a fungus, it impacts bats, especially species that hibernate in these big colonies by the hundreds and thousands. And we're seeing some bat species just in the last 10 years have declined by over 90%.
Wow.
And they're in danger of going extinct.
Is that all of them, including the ones here in Michigan, the 9 species you mentioned?
So there are a few. I would say 4 of the 9 species in Michigan that hibernate in these colonies, and they're at most risk of seeing a big decline from white nose syndrome.
Where, I'm not familiar where these hibernation areas, these colonies would be. Where would those be?
So the natural place where most of those bats hibernate would be caves. We don't have any real caves in lower Michigan. You get up into the UP, we have caves. And then bats also use mines, which are pretty similar to caves. And bats are really curious. They'll find these caves and mines and get into little crevices between the rocks and hibernate there. Sometimes just a few, but sometimes 20 or 30,000 bats. That's in the UP. Now in lower Michigan, interestingly, there are some man-made structures that bats hibernate in. There is an old mining tunnel near Alpena where they found a few bats. And then over toward Wellston, Tippy Dam, it's a hydroelectric dam. And there's a part of the dam that bats have found, and bats go in there and hibernate. 20,000 or more bats have been counted.
Seriously?
In Tippy Dam, yeah.
Is that like a tourist destination when they wake up or something? I mean, that's pretty significant.
Yeah. It's not really a tourist destination. So one of the concerns with white nose syndrome is that the way it spreads is by people, primarily. People like to explore caves.
Oh.
And unknowingly, people can get this fungus on their clothing, on their boots. They go into an infected cave, and then they travel to a different cave and bring the fungus with them. Wow. So people that are into caving, there's things you can do to be responsible and not spread the fungus. You can decontaminate. But so there's not a lot of bat-based tourism in lower Michigan.
So just talking about that, I mean, I've learned a bit by what you just said about humans transmitting it to other caves and such. How those who do spelunking, I guess the term is that widely known in the community of active people that they're careful about that?
Yeah, so there's a group, the National Speleological Society, for those that spelunk, and they are well informed about white nose syndrome, and that group is very responsible.
I would think that just like some of the hunters became concerned about wildlife, Ducks Unlimited or mm-hmm. something like that, even though you may be hunting or doing that species, you have to take care of that part of the population and be responsible. I think that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I think the hunting community is a good comparison. They're a big part of the conservation community, and similarly, cavers. Spelunkers are kind of the eyes and ears that help us figure out when something's going wrong with bats.
Well, are you familiar with any times where a spelunker maybe helped out the conservation effort?
You know, I'm not familiar with any specific
instances. That was off script, so that's okay.
But I imagine it's happened.
Yes, absolutely. Talk about this, when the population collapsed, how easy is it to restore? I mean, we're hearing wonderful, we've heard on Strong Tower Radio from some of the biologists about what has been done for the Kirkland warbler. And I'm really excited about that because I remember when they were down to, they were endangered and mm-hmm. now they're off the endangered list. Is it as easy to remedy this white nose syndrome when the population collapses of these bats as they've been so successful with the birds?
Yeah, I would say the outlook for the bats is not quite as rosy as it is for the Kirtland's warbler. So most of these bats, and there's really four species in Michigan that are impacted by white nose syndrome, they have one or two young a year, one or two pups. Bat young are called pups. And if you're having one or two young a year, it's going to take a long time to recover from a population crash where you lose 90%+ of the species. So it's going to go, it's going to be slow, and we still need to figure out how to stop white nose syndrome. And scientists are working hard to figure out how can we stop the effects of white nose.
Are they very optimistic? Are they hot on the trail, or is it still nebulous?
I think it's
there?
Still pretty nebulous. Ooh. People are attacking it from all kinds of different angles. But as someone who works with endangered species, you have to be optimistic. And so I am, you know, eternally optimistic. But it's going to be a slow recovery when you can only have one or two pups a year.
Yeah, well, you think about population replacement. You need what is the average lifespan of these bats that are endangered? Now, I know you said there's 1,400 species, mm-hmm. so I'm sure they have different lifespans and stuff. But the Michigan species, what is their normal lifespan?
Yeah, I want to say their lifespan is between 5 and 10 years.
So, in that period of time, if this, you know, you have a certain attrition rate, in order to replace that population. If they live 5 years, then within that 5 years, the bat population, this couple or whatever you want to call it, have to have at least more than more than two in order to reproduce, and then there's attrition and so
exactly.
on and so forth. It sounds a little tenuous, but we're going to be optimistic.
Yep. There are parts of the country where white nose syndrome has not reached them yet.
One isolated, huh?
And then like in Tippi Dam, the dam in Wellston where bats hibernate, we're not seeing the crash. The fungus has been detected in there, but we're not seeing the population crash in it. It might be due to the humidity in there or the temperature. So there are some reasons to be hopeful. Like I said, I'm optimistic.
Well, let me ask you this question. You said certain colonies. How big is their range of a particular bat? How many miles could one colony, Do they have migrations of bats?
So, yeah, bats, they do migrate. So they'll have the habitat they use in the summer, and they will then migrate to wherever they hibernate for the winter. And they could travel over 100 miles to get to a cave or a mine or a man-made structure. They can have pretty far migrations.
So they may not go as far as when we think of bird migrations, you tend to think of that in our area, going to a warmer climate, which would be 1,000 miles or something. Theirs is more localized.
Yeah. No bats around here are going down to the tropics, but bats in lower Michigan, they might go up to a cave or mine in the UP. They might go down to a cave or mine in Ohio or Kentucky.
Okay. There's a notable research biologist and professor. His name is Alan Curta.
Yeah, Dr. Alan Curta at Eastern Michigan University. He's the statewide expert on bats. He's done a lot of bat research on the Manistee National Forest. He's the one that does the annual bat count in Tippy Dam, counts how many bats are hibernating in there. He's the authority in Michigan on bats.
Well, that's awesome. Can you tell us a few other things that we might have missed so far on bats that might be of interest to our listeners?
Yeah, so this is kind of interesting. Another threat to bats is our wind turbines. And so bats typically fly at night. They don't have great vision. They can echolocate, but they can't see the wind turbines spinning. And so often bats are hit by wind turbines, and they can be killed, injured or killed by them.
So it's, what is, they take echolocation, it's like a picture, but the thing is moving.
Exactly.
So they might see it there, but it, mm-hmm. I see.
Okay. And so that's not the interesting thing. That's unfortunate. But the interesting thing are some of the ways people are trying to minimize bat injury and mortality from wind energy. So they've experimented with putting these ultrasonic bat deterrent systems on there, where the wind turbine, they produce a really high-pitched noise that humans can't hear, but bats can hear it, and it's supposed to deter them. People have tried putting UV lights on wind turbines, so lights that bats can see, we can't see them, and that helps bats be aware of them. And then just being aware of when bats are likely to be migrating through the area and lowering the speed on wind turbines. And so those together have helped minimize impacts to bats from wind energy.
Well, Scott, it's been a great pleasure having you on our program today, and I hope that our listeners have a new appreciation for bats.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Tom.
You're welcome. Is there any, if people would like further information, what would be a resource that they could access?
So there's an organization, Bat Conservation International, BCI. Folks can look up BCI on the internet, and they've got a lot of great information and resources related to bats.
Wonderful. Well, I really want to thank you for being a part of our program, and I understand you know other wildlife species, so we'll have to have you back.
Yeah, that'd sometime. Be great, Tom.
Thanks again, Scott. Listeners, you've been listening to Strong Tower Radio Features. I've been interviewing Scott Worson. He's a wildlife biologist with the United States Forest Service. Until next time, God bless you. Bye now.